We talk a lot on this podcast about chess improvement, but when it comes to improving your hiring processes, Indeed is the platform you need. Indeed has over 350 million global monthly visitors, and it has a matching engine that helps you find quality work candidates fast. You can use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with your candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree that Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Years ago, when I was running a chess teaching business, I found it hard to find good help, and I had to go through a lot of back and forth to even screen potential candidates. Indeed allows you to do those things efficiently in one place. Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences, so the more you use Indeed for hiring, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of Perpetual Chess will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility if you go to Indeed.com/chess. Just go to Indeed.com/chess right now, and you'll be supporting our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast, Indeed.com/chess. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Hello, everyone. I am Ben Johnson, and this is the Perpetual Chess Podcast. Perpetual Chess is a weekly interview show where top chess players, authors, content creators, and accomplished amateurs discuss their careers and share stories and chess improvement tips. Perpetual Chess is a part of the Blue Wire Podcast Network, and we'd like to give special thanks to our presenting chess education sponsor, Chessable.com. For more information about the show, you can go to PerpetualChessPod.com. But without further ado, let's get to the show. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Perpetual Chess. We are joined by someone I have long wanted to interview. He is a legend of British chess, three-time British champion, two-time world championship candidate. He's been ranked as high as number four in the world in 1989. He's also as a trainer who has worked as a second for some legends. He's an author, a chess-based columnist, and a Twitch streamer. And it is my great honor to welcome to the show Grandmaster Jonathan Spielman. Welcome, Jonathan.
Hello, Bennett. It's very nice. I'm going to enjoy this, I think.
Yeah, I am super excited. I've been reading, I read your columns anyway, but I've been digging through them, reviewing your biography, which one can still get on Kindle. And I've got a lot of questions related to sort of the highlights of your career, but we're recording this the day after the Speed Chess Championship. So, And I was pretty impressed with it. They had 150,000 concurrent viewers at different times during the match, which I found staggering, and it was quite entertaining on the heels of the World Cup. So I was just curious, Jonathan, if you watched it, and when you do, if it gives you an opportunity to reflect on how chess has changed over the course of your career.
Well, yes, I did watch it. I assumed that they would start after the World Cup had finished. I don't know if they moved the start time, but certainly that they weren't going to be playing chess when there was football on, I don't think. Well, clearly they weren't going to be. I watched the start of it. I was teaching somebody, actually, somebody quite strong, and we watched the first few games. And I thought Magnus, I thought he tried too hard in the first game he lost in the ending. He was trying too hard to beat Hikaru. And then Hikaru totally dominated him until I left. We went to have, what did we do? Had dinner or something. Then I came back at the end when Magnus was just starting to fight back in the bullet, and he actually equalized and then splattered again. And I thought it was there were some very dirty tricks. I thought queen to b4 takes b2 was very tricky of Hikaru. And obviously, Magnus took ages to get started, didn't he?
Yeah.
Because he didn't win a game till game, I don't know, 10 or something. Hikaru was just bashing him. So you said that they were interviewed and they were respectful about each other, which is nice. It's always nice when people, because I'm sure they do respect each other, in fact. But you don't need trash talk or any nonsense when you've got chess. You know, chess is nicest when people are basically rather polite to each other, I think.
Yeah, I agree. And again, we're recording this. There's going to be a big announcement from chess.com and Magnus in a couple of days. But certainly the subtext of I enjoyed both interviews with Hikaru and Magnus. But the subtext to me is that whatever format they're announcing, whatever future events, it seems like it won't be the last time we get to see Magnus and Hikaru tangle. And Magnus seemed emboldened by the challenge, even though he lost.
You know, no, it's great. I mean, you know, they are about, they're very equally matched, aren't they? I'm slightly surprised Magnus beat him in the bullet. I mean, I suppose Ali Reza would beat either of them at bullet, actually. But perhaps he's perhaps the best in the world. Yeah, I was watching recently, well, on Lee Chess, actually, but when Ali Reza was playing, who is Penguin GM?
Andrew Tang.
Andrew Tang, that's right. And they were playing Hyper Bullet. And I was, so they're playing 30 seconds. And the extraordinary thing to me is that for the first 15 to 20 seconds of those games, they look plausibly like games of chess. Because I'm just, I don't play bullet at all because I'm too old. And I mean, I can follow it fine. You know, my brain can follow it, but my hands can't move a mouse fast enough. So yeah, I've never really, I mean, I can play bullet on, well, 1 minute chess on a chessboard perfectly okay. But somehow moving a mouse, I'm just not very, very quick. So I don't.
And you recently turned 66, correct, John?
I did, sadly, yes. Yes, I am now formally a pensioner in England. Yes, I have my freedom pass.
Oh, well, congratulations.
Well, freedom pass we get. In London, you have something which means you can use all transport free. I mean, all the underground and the buses. And now in England at the moment, you get something so you can use any bus anywhere in England for free, which is actually rather a wonderful thing. And also, I think it's cost-effective, in fact, because by mobilizing these ancient codgers, you actually get them. First, they're healthier, and then they go and spend money doing things. So in terms of overall budgeting, it's actually a really good idea. But of course, there are different budgets being used.
Well, I'm glad that you get a nice perk, and it's nice to, this will be audio only, but I can see John, and he looks to be in good health. So one more on the Speed Chess Championship, Jonathan. Of course, you come from the age of the smoke-filled rooms and the, you know, occasionally.
We didn't have that much smoke-filled rooms when I was young. I mean, there are the stories, aren't there, about Botvinnik practicing against somebody blowing smoke into his face.
Right.
Allegedly, yeah, supposedly. And, you know, that seems quite plausible. But certainly, it's a very different thing now. I mean, internet chess is different from over-the-board chess, and I prefer over-the-board. I mean, I love playing blitz over the board. But, I mean, I haven't played much internet blitz at all recently. I just don't do it. I mean, I suppose I could do, and I'm reasonably competent, but I'm a bit slow. I can do 3+2 absolutely fine.
Right.
3 fine, but any faster than that, I'm just, you know, don't like it.
And do you watch a lot of these online events?
I watch quite a lot of them, yeah. It just depends what's going on. I certainly do. I thought that they slightly merged into each other, some of the Meltwater stuff and things. You know, there were so many tournaments with almost the same people. But then when you watch a match like that, like they just had, it's very interesting seeing them making war. And the way that they both beat up their opponents on the way to the final was very impressive. And the way Magnus beat up MVL was very impressive, I thought.
Yeah, Magnus said something in the post-game interview, something like he thought all along there was about a 5% chance he or Hikaru would lose to someone other than each other. Like,
really?
Like he didn't think it was likely at all.
Because they didn't have Ali Reza, I assume, in this.
Or... Yeah, I don't believe they did. I don't know what he's been doing. Last I saw, he's not in the World Rapid and Blitz either.
No. Is it the World Rapid or the European Rapid? Is it the World?
Well, he's not playing in the World.
There's just been a European, hasn't there?
Yeah.
Which was won by some guy. Michael Adams was playing and then lost some guy from trying to win a drawn ending, and then came a point off the lead. I saw a few games.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, let's get into your career a little more, Jonathan. There's so many questions I'm excited to ask you. I've got to begin with one where you've written and said a few times that Vasily Ivanchuk is the most talented player you've ever encountered.
And absolutely. It's partly because he totally bashed me in a way that neither of the Ks did. I mean, I had about 50%, i.e. about as many losses as draws. And I had won one position against him in my life at Linares, and I missed it, and then we drew soon afterwards. And he was extraordinary, and is extraordinary. I mean, the move knight d7 he played a few weeks ago.
Amazing.
Yeah, I was at the, my last tournament was the UK Open Blitz, which was, when it's called Open Blitz, it had qualifiers. And this meant that the top guys didn't play because, you know, you had to be in London at the right time or something to get into it. There weren't any designated spots. So there was this Open Blitz tournament, and the qualifier for London was actually about 7 minutes walk from me. So obviously I played. It was in Adam Rowe is the guy who ran it, a British organizer. And so I got to the final, and actually I was first equal with a Ukrainian guy living in England and won it, but I mean on tiebreak. But I did get absolutely splatted by a 12-year-old Scottish boy who is very, very little. He still hasn't had a birth spurt, a guy called Freddie Gordon. He's got a German mother, who is very, very talented. And anyway, so where have I got lost? I've got lost as to why I started.
Ivanchuk,
right. Yeah. And the reason was that there was a women's tournament next to ours, which was won by opposition Russian, who's married to the Ukrainian, who was first equal with me, a woman called Mirzoeva. And one of the women stopped me and said, oh, she's a friend of Jordan Van Foreest. So I asked, did he fall off his chair? I mean, but I would love to have seen film of his face after that. I'm sure there isn't any.
Yeah. So let me just give a little context, Jonathan, for any listeners who did not see, or at least maybe are not actively recalling. So in the World Team Championship, and Jonathan wrote about this in his Chess Base column, and I'm sure there's tons of videos online. Ivanchuk played this amazing move. It's commonly referred to as sort of a Novotny theme move, which
it's sort of
a
Novotny. Yeah. Do you know what a Novotny is?
Yes, and I like the little definition you shared in your column.
A Novotny is an interference. Sorry, of course you do. Sorry. A Novotny is an interference between two pieces. You put a piece on the square where their lines intersect, a rook and a bishop, say. So the rook's going, sorry, it's not going to help because this is video, isn't it? The rook's going up, the bishop's going across. There's a square in the middle. You put a piece in between on the intersection, and whichever piece takes it maintains its function. It's important. It doesn't lose its function, but it interferes with the function of the other piece. It's basically an active, there's another study theme, which is, what the hell is it called?
I'm drawing a blank.
There's a problem theme, a Grimshaw. A Grimshaw is the same thing, but where you don't put a piece in the interfering square, but they have to interfere each other for some reason. So the if your readers can visualize this, the archetypical Novotny, white has pawns on e7 and a7, so they're both trying to queen. Black has a bishop in h1 and a rook in e1. So one of the pieces stops each of those passed pawns. The rook in e1 stops the e-pawn on the e-file. The bishop in h1 stops the pawn on a7. And you put a piece on e4, archetypically a bishop. If rook takes bishop, a8 equals queen. And if bishop takes bishop, e8 equals queen.
Yeah, so that would be black putting a bishop on e4.
White. Yeah, because they're white pawns in the center. Yeah. And that is called a Novotny after Antonin Novotny, who You can Google him. I mean, obviously this is online. If you Google Novotny and specify it as being chess rather than a Czech politician, then you will find a rather good Wikipedia article about this.
And you should definitely check out the game from Ivanchuk and Van Forest.
Ivanchuk and Van Forest is fantastic, yeah.
Yeah.
So I just think he's a genius. And people used to say, Michael Adams or Nigel Short used to say, he was the only player they ever played who they had no idea what his next move was going to be.
Right. So
everybody else, you know, you sort of knew what was going to happen. Sometimes they were going to punch you in the face, and it was tough. If Kasparov punched you in the face, he did so, and there was nothing you could do about it. But you knew what sort of moves were going to hit you, whereas with Ivanchuk, you just didn't.
And is your opinion of him as the most impressive player you've seen, is it informed by post-mortem analysis as well, or mainly just your games against him and his moves?
He's just, his whole view of chess, he sees the chessboard in a way which is extraterrestrial and powerfully extraterrestrial. You know, it isn't, it's just wonderful. So I think he's a genius, you know. I mean, I think Kasparov and Karpov obviously are in their own ways as well. I mean, Kasparov is one of the best, you know, two or three attacking players of all time, together with Tal and Alekhine. And Karpov is perhaps the best player. I don't know, maybe Magnus is as good at this now. One of the best middle game players ever, just at putting his pieces in good squares. Karpov just could play moves very quickly, very easily. Good moves, often the best move. I mean, Karpov's great game, and there are a couple of them. One of them is his game with Spassky from a candidate's final. Was it maybe even a semi-final, where he played a lot of tiny moves, including knight c3 to b1. Spassky played a Scheveningen and got a position that looked perfectly playable. And there was a series of maybe a dozen moves where it looked as though Spassky wasn't playing moves at all, but Karpov was. And all of Karpov's pieces ended up on the best squares. Spassky ended up all over the board, sort of falling back all over the board, and then Karpov killed him. Absolutely fantastic game. Do you need a reference? Or I can get you a reference.
That's okay. Go on. And
yeah, I mean, I can find it, but I'll have to go and look in a chess base.
Oh, that's okay. We'll get that later. And I will link to any games referenced in the show description. Any other favorite Karpov games?
Well, there's Karpov Korchnoi, the famous dragon.
The dragon, yeah.
Yeah, that's rather wonderful. I think it's those two are the really good ones. I've got a database of Karpov. Oh, Karpov Unzicker, of course. Do I mean Unzicker Ullmann?
Yeah.
I mean, there's one with Bishop A7 in the Royal Lopez where he doubles and plays Bishop A7 on the A file. That I think is Unzicker.
It is. Ullmann, yeah, classic.
There's Ullmann in an Tarash French with a bishop on B5 where he just completely squashes him as well. You just felt that this was a very, very dangerous player. And, you know, generally he crushed me. I mean, I did get him once, but in all the horrors, but yeah.
How many times do you recall playing him in classical?
Maybe 10 or something. I think I probably lost 5-1-1 and drew 4, something like that. I don't know. I mean, I could look it up. I can tell you in a few seconds because I can look at my own database of my games, which will be fairly accurate.
And I'm sure when you look at your games like that, does like a flood of stories come to mind as you look at each game and sort of zero in?
Some of them not. I mean, my memory's not that good, actually. I mean, quite often I can't remember if I played people if the games weren't very memorable.
But that's good to hear, because some of the people I interview, their level of recall is quite disturbing for an average person, such as myself.
Well, I don't have a particularly. It's interesting because I'm not very good at names, but I quite often see a person, know which games of chess I've played with them, probably know which relationships they've had, know right. where they live, but can't remember their bloody name. That happens quite often, actually.
And it always has. It's not just the
it's not because I'm getting old and codgery. No, just I'm just quite often lose names. But I mean, you know, then I get them back eventually. Or, of course, I can just look up a game and find them that way if I'm near a chess base. So, you know, that's if funny. They're chess players. Yeah.
Yeah. And let me ask you, John, so you've had the chance, obviously you just mentioned Kasparov and Karpov. You've also worked briefly, famously, on Korchnoi's team in Montpellier.
He sacked me very quickly. That wasn't...
Yeah. So why did he sack you?
I think he just didn't think I was doing very good work. He wasn't an easy man to be a second for, I don't think. He was quite I liked him, but I thought, you know, you're a grumpy old whatever, but you've lived through the siege of Leningrad. So
right.
What do you expect of somebody who's lived through that? They're not going to be easy, are they? I mean, you know, if you've lived through something as terrible as that, then you're bound to be a bit difficult, you know. But I've also been, of course, Anand second and Nigel Short second.
Right. So let's hear about those.
Well, I mean, it was a lot easier than being Viktor Lvovich's second, I think. And the Nigel match didn't go very well. I mean, I'd already agreed to do television work, so I was doing a television show as well as that, which was nice because I'm not very good at sitting on my hands at home when they're playing. I mean, I can work very intensively, but not for very long periods, maybe. And basically, the first half, I was working with Robert Huebner. So I was energy and he was mass. And the idea was that we looked at the Nydorf and I tried to blow it to pieces. It was just before computers. Lines of the Nydorf were Nigel was playing bishop c4. So I would try to rip Robert's head off and he would defend himself. And I would be astounded and confounded because he would defend himself quite often and just keep his extra piece and win, and didn't seem to be perturbed by the energy being beamed at his position. So that was that one. That was in London. The second half of the match, Kasparov was being divorced, which didn't help him at all. I think his wife told him she was going to divorce him round about game 10 of 20 or something. And Nigel did quite well in the second half. He won one game, I think. And Kasparov basically just cantered to victory, but without being that impressive. The other match was in New York at the top, of course, the Twin Towers, which aren't there anymore. That was Anand and Kasparov. We did quite a lot of intensive work somewhere. Where the hell was it? Was it in France? Trying to think. Where did she have his place?
He had a place in Spain, right?
In Spain, sorry, it was in Spain, wasn't it? Yeah, that's right, yes. And we went there and did quite a lot of work. There was Patrick Wolf, there was myself, and there was Arthur Yusupov. And then we were there for the 6 weeks of the match or whatever, because, of course, these matches went on much, much longer than they do now. It was 24 games, wasn't it? And that was a real education in match play. I've always understood matches much better after that. I don't know if you know the outline of the match. Well, I'll tell you, readers, anyway. So it started off, Anand was probing against the Scheveningen, basically, the Sicilian Scheveningen, playing different systems, trying to get an advantage. Kasparov, because it was 20 games, started, I think, with one knight f3 or one d4, and then moved around trying to find a weakness. So eventually, maybe his third white, he tried 1e4, and he found out that Vichy was playing the open defense to the Lopez, which, of course, is both a wonderful opening and a gaping wound because it's en prise to enormous numbers of different forced variations. And that game was drawn. Then Kasparov took a timeout and tried a Scotch. I can't remember which order he tried the Scotch and the open Spanish. I mean, people can find out. I've got it. And then eventually, round about game, I can't remember even who was white in the first game. Vichy won a game against the Scheveningen. And at that moment, it was imperative to move out of the way. We didn't realize this. We'd analyzed the open Lopez in huge detail, but we analyzed half a move too late. We missed something, and we got hit with an enormous punch. in game about 10 of the match. And Kasparov knocked him over, basically. Now, Vichy had got a second defense at least, which was the center counter, and he should have moved the after hitting Kasparov, when the guy was enraged and hence very dangerous, he should have moved to the center counter. Because at that point, Kasparov would have been hopping mad not to have played his novelty, and also slightly on tilt, I think. He was so ferociously determined to win. And that would probably have led to a completely different match. What actually happened was Kasparov won with his huge theoretical punch, and then he switched to the dragon, which he'd never played before. And we didn't even know there was a book on the dragon. Who was it by? Was it by Soltis, maybe? There was some book on... I can't remember. You see, I'm not very good at specifics. Oh, on the main line of the Yugoslav attack with H4 and H5 in, that there was a book that started about move 16. And Jonathan Mestel told us about this. I mean, because he's my old friend from here. And so he said, there is this book, and we managed to get it across. But the first time that Kasparov played the dragon, Vichy reacted in the way that was expected, and he actually lost. So, and then when Vichy played the center counter in the next one, he got the advantage, but was not feeling good at that point. Kasparov swindled him. So it went from plus one to minus two in three games or something. And that was really the end of the match. But I learned quite a lot about timing, that you have to grasp what's going on in the match. And that's something you only learn firsthand. It's not something seeing it from the outside. It's hard. Now I can look at a match and say, I think this is the moment to do something. I may be right or I may be wrong. But I can feel that, you know, something's building up. But at that time, I just didn't understand match play as well as all that.
And do you feel like, I also got to interview Patrick Wolf, and he told some stories from that match. Do you feel like it was your responsibility to sort of see around corners, as you're describing?
No, I wasn't the Arthur was the basically primary second, so I wasn't really asked what to do. So, I mean, I could have made a fuss, but I mean, we had lots of work to do. Obviously, the player is going to choose somebody he's happy to ask those sort of questions, and he'll probably ask in a subsidiary way the other seconds. So no, I didn't think it was my responsibility. I thought that if I'd understood matches as I do now, then I would have made a much bigger fuss, yes, at that moment. Because had I thought about it in a meta way, and just thought the open Spanish is really a dangerous opening to play. Why don't you hit him while he's off balance? Then that would have been, probably we'd have got hit in the open Spanish eventually, because she couldn't play more than one center counter, certainly not more than two. But no, I didn't think it was my responsibility, but I thought it was a shame. I did sort of make a slight fuss, I think, but not very much. I mean, there's so much going on, you know, you're working. Yeah. Hours a day, and then I was able to go to the games and watch the games while they were happening, which was nice. So I had some time off then. And you just don't, you know, you assume your player is going to choose who he asks what he should play. And if he doesn't ask you, that's not really up to you to push yourself.
And when you watch a game like that, you've worked on the team, you go to the World Trade Center to watch the game, is that more or less nerve-wracking than competing in a high-stakes game yourself?
It's different, isn't it? I mean, I think watching people and not being able to influence it is in some ways more nerve-wracking. Because, personally, I'm very nervous before I play normally, even now. But once I'm playing, I'm just, you know, you're playing a game of chess. One of the wonderful things about a game of chess is that every time you play a move, the myriad possibilities are whittled down so that you don't, you know, that's what's so horrible about adjournments, you know, that you have some position which is still very complicated and then you're supposed to work it out properly rather than just sort of being in the moment and doing something sensible.
Makes sense. And so... obviously, that's a, you know, you describe this sort of turning point when Kasparov won in the Roy and then shifted the momentum of the match. Looking back, John, do you feel like Anand had, was he strong enough yet to beat Kasparov? Could he have won that match?
I don't know. I think he would have had a decent chance if we'd got the gear changes right. Yeah. But probably that's part of being a strong enough player, isn't it? Of understanding, you know, of just being able to take that much strain and understand what's happened. Because until you've done it, you're not going to know. And I think having been close to it, you have some idea of what it's like, you know. And as I said, if we're doing something like that now, I would make much more of a fuss. I mean, I might not be that useful for analysis, apart from suggesting crazy moves. but I would have a strong feeling of what needed to be done and when.
And when I know you in your column wrote about, for example, the Carlsen-Nepo match, which ended up being a bit anticlimactic. Do you find yourself thinking about match strategy a lot as you watch?
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Nepo basically didn't. I suppose he didn't quite believe he could win, did he? Or he hoped he could win, but when he got hit once, he couldn't really recover, which is not a strong enough position to be in. You have to be able to be punched and to stagger a bit and then get up and keep on fighting. I mean, obviously he got punched in the worst, absolutely the worst possible way in the game, the first game he lost. It's the most horrible way to lose a game imaginable. But, you know, if you're going to play a match with Magnus, you can imagine something awful is going to happen at some point.
Right.
And you have to be ready for it and think, okay, something awful has happened. We fight again and not be so affected. I mean, one strength I do have is that I'm never so surprised by my own stupidity. But if I play some awful blunder, I think, well, I'm not very pleased that I curse. And, you know, you do the things you do. But I'm not surprised. I don't think, how could you possibly do that? Because I know I'm a person rather than a robot, or rather a chess engine. And so my search function doesn't always work. And sometimes things go wrong, you know. So I don't feel shocked by that in terms of existentially. I may be shocked at how badly I played, but not the fact that I played badly, if that makes sense.
There's an amazing lesson for all of us club players in that. It makes sense. I mean, we're humans, you know.
Absolutely. Well, I did an interview for Chess Magazine. There was 10 minutes with, and the final thing was, what's your advice for club players? And I said something like, trust yourself, even if you're playing some terrible maestro. If you see a good move, then don't not play it because it can't possibly work. You know, if that's the move that you think is a good move, play it. But on the other hand, if it looks like taking candy from a child, I didn't say it, looks too good, then sit in your hands, because normally a good player won't allow you to do something ridiculously strong. So probably if there's something that looks too good to be true, it is too good to be true.
Great advice. All right. Well, I want to get some more stories from you, John, but first we need to take a break and hear from our sponsors. I've been due for an update from our friends at aimchess.com. Aimchess, of course, gathers games from the major chess playing sites and gives you actionable intel of what aspects of your game to work on, and it helps you work on them. I've been working on some new openings in my Blitz game. It turns out I'm doing pretty decently with those new openings. Of course, I've got to keep them a secret from you guys. But I still have some other things to work on. Time management slightly better, but lots and lots of room to improve. I also need to work on advantage capitalization and resourcefulness. On the other hand, my end games are doing well and my openings are doing well overall. So if you're looking for that kind of insight, as well as puzzles of tactics that you missed and chances to practice positions you didn't convert, then try out aimchess.com. If you do so, please use the code perpetual30 at aimchess.com. The link is also in the show description. Hear that sound? You should know what that means. It's your sign to finally forget about the run-of-the-mill resolutions and instead start your own New Year's revolution and start selling on Shopify. Shopify is an e-commerce platform revolutionizing millions of businesses worldwide. So whether you're selling chess courses, chess lessons, something unrelated to chess, perhaps related to your day job or side hustle. Shopify covers every sales channel from in-person point of sale to an all-in-one e-commerce platform. You can sell on social media marketplaces. It's packed with industry-leading tools ready to ignite your growth and gives you complete control over your business and your brand without having to learn new skills or learn how to code. And thanks to 24/7 help and an extensive business course library, Shopify is there to help you support your success every step of the way. What's great about Shopify is how no matter how big you want to grow, Shopify is there to empower you with the confidence and control to revolutionize your business, take your business to the next level. Now it's your turn to get serious about selling and try out Shopify today. So if you decide to try it out, sign up for $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/chess. That's shopify.com/chess, all lowercase. And remember, when you try out our sponsors, you're also helping to support Perpetual Chess. In this case, it's a win-win because you can also take your business to the next level with shopify.com. And we are back. And Jonathan, supporters of the podcast are able to send in questions from the guest. And this particular supporter, Deshaun Solomon, thanks for the question. And shout out to Deshaun. I think he did his homework or he's a big student of yours, because his question is, he asks both for your general comments on beating Nigel Short in a match in the late 80s, of course, in the candidate cycle. And particularly, he mentions, and I read this as well, that you found an idea from a Norwegian newspaper to win one of the games, which also harkens back to what you were saying about like scrambling to find a book in 1995, and makes me think of like in the middle of a world championship match, and makes me think of how much things have changed.
Yeah. So he wants to know about that. Right. Well, so I played this match. Will Watson was my second for the first matches, but he thought Nigel was our best player. So he very honorably didn't want to be my second against our best player. And he's friends with both of us. So he bowed out and he recommended Jonathan Tisdall. So Tis became my second. And I went to Norway a couple of times to work and had some ideas, I've never been very good at preparation before, because until I'm actually frightened. The thing is, in order to access my true feelings about chess, I need to be scared of losing. So if I'm playing a game, I look at a position and probably there's one move I want to play. There might be two I'd consider. If I'm analyzing away and I'm calm and I'm having coffee, then there are two or three moves, and I think, well, I might do that, or might do that, or might do that. And that just isn't how I really feel about chess. I just feel this is the move I want to play. It may not be the best move, but it's the move I want to play. And so I've never been that good at preparation, in fact. For that match, the best idea I had, we were in a taxi on the way to a friendly game between, football game between Norway and Brazil. And I thought, what would I play in this position? Because obviously, I was thinking about the match. And I had this idea of fianchettoing in a French. And that was, it was in a, what is it, a bishop g5, takes knight bd7 French, where black plays g6, or h6 then g6. And it's sort of nonsense. I mean, the first question Nigel had to me after the match is, what was that? That was his absolute first question. And I thought, this is probably not sound, but I can't prove it. Thank God we didn't have engines then. And it will discombobulate him, and it's the move I would like to play in this position. So I was able to access that. I played it, and that was great. The thing that happened in this match, the first game, I didn't know Nigel had been working with Boris Spassky on the Tartakova. Obviously, I didn't know that. I played my normal stuff against the Queen's Gambit Tartakova, got outplayed, managed to make a draw, managed to create some confusion. In between game one and game three, Mikhail Gurevich played two games in the Russian Championship. I think we had both of them. We certainly had one of them, in which he castled long in the bishop f4 queen's gambit, what is now one of the main lines. At that stage, the best source of information was Schachwoche, which came out once a week from Switzerland. Is that, I think, Switzerland, isn't it? Yeah. So Chess Week came out once a week. And we were in between weeks. But when Tisdall's wife, then wife, and now divorced, came out, when Mariana came out to the match, she brought a Norwegian newspaper with this game in, which was fantastic.
And just happenstance, or did you ask?
Just happenstance.
Wow.
I mean, she's a chess player. She used to play for Norway. And Mariana came out, and we saw this game, and we thought, and Tiz persuaded me to play it. I didn't like it very much, but I thought, it's something I can play, and I played a bloody good game. I mean, it's the first time I'd played it, the first time Nigel met it, and he played reasonably well, but I played a good game, you know, like a proper strong player, and happened to win. And that completely discombobulated him. And then the next game, there was a Pierce where I was very lucky. He played something against the Pierce. His second was John Nunn. He got a good position. I played a move, and I didn't realize I was sacrificing a piece, which is very lucky, because Nigel took about 40 minutes. And I don't think I'd even seen that he was winning a piece until maybe a couple of minutes before he did it. Probably something about his body language at some point caught me. And so he won a piece, but it was for two pawns, and I had quite a lot of play, and it got out of control, and I beat him. So in two games, we'd gone from 1-1 to 3-1. And then I had to not lose in a Catalan. Actually, I didn't play the opening very well, but he didn't notice. And so I beat him in that Catalan. No, we drew. I was winning at the position where we agreed a draw. Now, whether that's weakness or not, I don't think so. I think it's a sensible thing to do. But in some ways, when you're punching your rival, you should keep on doing so, even if it's not clear. And then he beat me the next match round, just. I think he lost a stone in a week playing that first match. So, you know, it was incredible strain for both of us.
You were stressed as well?
Of course I was stressed, yes.
Yeah.
But I had the advantage of being the underdog, at least at the start.
And the first match was in London, correct?
Yeah, it was in London. It was at Sadler's Wells Theatre, which is where they used to do Gilbert and Sullivan operettas.
Do you feel like that impacted your nerves either positively or negatively? You mentioned in your book that Nigel just lived down the street from you. So it's like this global stakes, but it's so local for you.
I don't know. I didn't particularly want to play him, but I mean, I had to, and you just have to do it. And my nerves were quite good then, I think. My nerves still are fine, you know. I mean, other bits of me, my eyes are crap, but I mean, my nerves are okay. And I can, yeah, once I'm playing chess, I'm reasonably okay. I may be very tense. One thing that does happen to me, I don't know, it happens to some chess players, my sense of time goes completely when I'm playing chess.
Yeah, for sure.
So I have no idea how long I've played, but also, if I'm sitting at a chessboard and I'm next to a game, which, you know, is in the next board to me, I probably know what happened episodically, or I may not even know that, but I won't know the whole game. I won't necessarily know the result or anything, just because I'm so focused.
Yeah, so makes sense.
So that's manic focus, yeah.
So let's bring it forward in that candidate cycle. So after you beat Short, you play Jan Timman.
I did. That was in, oh, wait a minute. No, we played in the Barbican against Jan. That's right.
And that came down to one game, right?
Came down to game 8, yeah. Yeah, he beat me. Then I beat him in the Schliemann, which was Jonathan Tisdall's idea. And game 7, I was a bit late because I actually came on the tube, which was nice. I was trying to be as normal as possible. Uh-huh. So we had a house somewhere quite close where he was staying, and we did the analysis, but I just took the underground there because it seemed like the most normal thing that one could do in order to stay grounded. And I beat Jan. I was a couple of minutes late to that game. Then in game 8, he beat me in an English, and later...
Do you mind before we go on? I just want to hear your thoughts about playing the Schliemann, because obviously, I mean, it's a decent opening, but I would be surprised to see it in a candidate cycle now. Was it scary to play?
Well, we knew what Jan played against it, and so we found a way to be not too much worse, or maybe to be almost equal. And obviously, it's a shock, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, of course.
You know, a shock is worthwhile. You know, I mean, maybe everybody knows everything now, but I mean, Magnus jumps around like crazy now, doesn't he? And I think it's just a good idea. You've only got, it was only an 8-game match, so you've got 4 blacks, and you just want to cause as much confusion as possible. And I also had to win at that point.
Okay.
I was 1 down. So it causes stress, doesn't it? You know, like Michael Basman, who so sadly died. I mean, one of his most famous games he'd beaten with E4, G5, you know. And, you know, it's worthwhile. Chess is quite a lot psychological. It's a war between two people, you know, probably fought with luck, with a very good spirit. And afterwards, you can be good friends or indeed very good friends. But during it, you're at war and you do whatever you can to cause trouble. So, no, I don't explain the Sleeman sword. So the last game, I blundered at some point in Yan 1. And then when I saw him in Amsterdam, I don't know, a year or two later, one of his neighbors had bottled some wine with the position where I lost to him. So Yan showed me this bottle, but he didn't open it. And that I do resent. I don't mind the bottle at all, but the lack of opening was disgraceful.
Wonder if he still has it.
I wonder if he still has it, yeah. No, of course, because you could keep the bottle and not open it. But you do feel that maybe he thought, I don't know, maybe he thought that giving me some of the wine from that bottle would be rude. I don't know. He may have done.
Right.
Anyway, yeah.
And do you often think back? I mean, obviously, you've achieved an incredible amount in your career. But so you were at the doorstep. Did Timon play Karpov after winning that match? Or
Timon played Karpov. Yeah, I was frightened of Karpov. I didn't really want to play him that much. So.
Okay.
So I don't think I could have done that. What Nigel did against Karpov was fantastic, actually, before he played Kasparov.
Did that surprise you?
Yeah, and I admired it greatly as well. A little bit surprised me. I mean, I knew Nigel is more determined than me and probably more able to shut off his sense of his own weakness. But yeah, that was tremendous what Nigel did. I did... No, but about all those times, and then the next match, I lost to Nigel in game 10. We ended up playing 8 games. And, I've slightly regretted trying to fool myself into not believing it was important while I was doing it. But on the other hand, if I hadn't, I might have done much worse. Because I think you have to find the important thing if you're doing something as difficult as playing a World Championship match or candidates match is to create a space in which you can operate. That's the most important thing, whatever you're doing. If you're playing at the club or playing a club game, you have to get in, you have to be sufficiently comfortable you can think and you can make reasonable decisions. And in order to do that, you need to be in some sort of zone, you know, not a comfort zone, but not so far outside your comfort zone. People can operate far outside their comfort zones for a while, but it normally doesn't last very long. You know, there are people who can go way above their ambient level for a little while by enormously hard work, but it's a bit brittle because unless their ambient level actually goes up, then all the time they're fighting to stay, to keep enough advantage from the opening or whatever so that they don't end up doing battle on equal terms with somebody who may be a bit better than them.
Great, great perspective there. It's so interesting to hear you discuss these historic matches and just, you know, general advice that we can learn from as well. John, we need to take one more break and then we will be back to hear some more stories. Perpetual Chess is proud to be brought to you in part by our presenting chess education sponsors, Chessable.com. Chessable, of course, uses spaced repetition to help you remember tactical patterns, opening sequences, whatever aspect of your game that you're working on, and they have a huge library of awesome courses. So whatever it is you want to work on, there's a good chance you can find something to help you on Chessable. Some of their latest includes a lifetime repertoires course on the London from Grandmaster Sahaj Grover and Srinath Narayanan. Now, I don't want you to play in London personally, but if you're going to do it, then this is a good learning resource. Grandmaster Alex Cholovich has a new course on Bobby Fischer's Endgames. Of course, the legend R.B. Ramesh's Improve Your Chess Calculation if you really want to challenge yourself. So there's always tons to check out from chessable.com. They have lots of free courses to check out as well. So just be sure to go to Chessable, get a streak going, and see what they have to offer.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
And we are back. And John, another thing that caught my eye in reviewing your book, you mentioned that unfortunately your father died when you were young, so you grew up without a dad, and you drew a parallel between some of the greats. Korchnoi had his harrowing upbringing, and there's Petrosian, Kasparov. Do you think there's something there in terms of all these great players growing up without dads, or is it just a coincidence?
I don't think it's as crude as what Ruben Fine might have suggested. I don't think that you're killing the father or something, or doing a substitute for that, or I don't think chess is that Oedipal, but probably you may not having a male role model may make you make war in different ways from if you did. I don't know. It's true that quite a lot. Yeah, I forgot I said that, but of course that's true, yeah. It's certainly not universally true, you know, but a lot of top players, I mean, Kasparov had a very strong mother, didn't he?
Right.
Very strong person. I don't know so much about Petrosian. His father died when he was young, did he? I think I sort of knew that.
Yeah, he was an orphan. And I forgot to mention Fischer, of course.
Yeah, well, Fischer had a very difficult upbringing and was, obviously had an enormous Oedipus complex and all these, I mean, you know, their Ruben Fine did. And big troubles with his mother, yeah. Yes, he was, of course, a genius, but pretty difficult man.
And do you feel like this, were you, like, hard driving? I mean, you've written that you were relatively late bloomer, I believe, earning the GM title at age 24, which, you know, doesn't sound that late, but in modern times it certainly is.
Very late, yeah, for that. For then it wasn't so late. I was already 24, yeah. It was the end of 1980, yeah, before my first Olympiad in Malta.
And were you like a freewheeling type, or were you working really hard on your game, John?
I worked a little bit. I mean, the thing is, I always thought what I really thought was, surely there is somebody who can play chess who will beat me up. And eventually I found Kasparov, Karpov, and Ivanchuk, and they probably could play chess. And nobody else, well, Korchnoi could, but I mean, I could confuse him as well. And so I kept on looking for somebody so much better than me that it made sense, and being surprised that people didn't play that well. And yeah, I mean, I wasn't very confident because I didn't beat an IM until 19. I didn't beat a grandmaster till I beat Ben Larsen in Lone Pine, I think in 77. 76 or 77, I beat Ben. And that was the first time I'd beaten a grandmaster. So I was I had some sort of barrier and some sort of respect, so which the kids nowadays obviously don't. That they will beat grandmasters when they're just about into their teens, and then they're not frightened anymore. And of course, it does make a difference watching people now online. Huge difference. Well, first you have all this barracking from these people who seem to believe that because a machine has seen something, it's stupid of the players not to, which is of course completely ridiculous. You know, the idea that because a machine sees some ridiculously difficult move, any human being would see it is nonsense. And, you know, one thing I can do, I mean, I don't stream very much now, but when I do, is to say, well, I think they're thinking about this and that it is reasonable that they should see this and it is not reasonable they should see that. And have a decent idea. Maybe the kids now are going to see more because they work with computers more, but the people who are a bit older, even Magnus or whatever, you know, not going to see some moves just because you don't see them. You know, why would you? I mean, seeing that d7, you know, just, you know, blows my mind.
Yeah, bringing it back to the Ivanchuk.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, you just think, and, you know, sometimes people do things very, very quickly. I saw MVL, you know, there's a combination where you put a queen on h8 or h1 or something, they take it, you take a pawn with a knight and fork king and queen, which happens, is a well-known combination. I saw MVL do that in about a second once in a blitz game. Less than a second, he played queen h1 check. And, of course, Hikaru just played queen to b4 check takes b2 yesterday. But I think he was thinking about it for more than that because Magnus was thinking. But, you know, you just think sometimes you don't see a tactic and you think, oh, these boys are pretty quick.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was, I caught that. That was like the Hikaru one, like a two-move tactic, but man, did he see it fast. And yeah, that was a big moment.
I think he'd seen it probably.
Yeah, well before. Right, yeah. Of course.
So he just thought, oh, yeah, that I can trick the world champion. As he did. So, yeah.
So, but you, I mean, so I'm just still curious, John, because you made it to number four in the world. It's so incredible. And you studied math at Oxford. You've written that you don't have any regrets, but.
No, I'm not that good at math. I didn't think I was number four. I thought I was in the top 10, but it wasn't unreasonable I should be ranked number four, but that I wasn't really number four. I was one of the top 10 in the world properly. And my peak rating, you know, you go up and down. I had a matches with Yasser and Nigel, so it's because they're going to go up, aren't they, your rating? And it was only 26, 40 or 45, but of course, at that stage, that's probably 100 points more than, you know, or something. I mean, it's not clear what the inflation is. And of course, the kids play really well today, all of them, you know, Gukesh and all these boys.
Yeah, they're amazing. And you can see, and you know, I recently got to interview Srinath Narayanan, Gacy's trainer, and there's a seriousness of mind about, especially the rising Indian players, but a lot of the young players, that's quite striking. And I'm curious, when you were in your early 20s and you decided, as you've written about in the past, you decided not to pursue. You mentioned you studied math, so you didn't want to be an actuary or an accountant. You decided to pursue chess. But what was your approach to pursuing chess? Because I know you have a lot of interests outside of chess. Were you studying it 40, 50 hours a week, or were you just living your life?
I've never been very good at studying it. As I said, I'm basically a player, and I'm and a hacker, really. Quite a lot of
you're an inspiring hacker.
The games I like actually are either pure hackery or extreme subtlety. I like very subtle endings as well. So I like either a scalpel or a bludgeon, really, but not much in between. And is a bludgeon, or you bludgeon with a bludgeon is not a tool, is it? Anyway. So this is some sort of baseball bat, maybe, or a scalp, nothing much in between. And no, I didn't study that much just because I wasn't that good at it. Because, as I said, I find it really, really hard to access my true feelings about chess unless I'm playing. And then it's very easy.
Interesting.
And that's not an advice. I mean, you know, that's why I wasn't a bit better, I think, because, you know, okay. I think you know, in talent, I'm quite good, but I mean, my preparation was pretty crap always. My preparation was avoiding other people's preparation. On the other hand, the English do have an advantage. We have the advantage we just weren't trained, and which is both a terrible thing, of course, compared to modern children, and also rather a wonderful thing because it means that we would do things that no Russian schoolboy could contemplate.
You know, such as the Schliemann, yeah.
Well, such as the Schliemann and Basman playing his g5 and his a6, and you know, all this. So, and of course, Tony playing a6 against Karpov, after which Karpov wouldn't play chess with him for a while. So it was such an insult.
Yeah, fantastic stories. And John, the aforementioned Jan Timman, he strikes me sort of as a kindred spirit. I don't know what your personal relationship with him is like.
Very good. I like that.
Okay. Yeah. But I interviewed.
With most people, you know, I mean, basically, you make war, it means you can be much more comfortable. I mean, the great thing about chess rather than, say, music is that there is a result, isn't there? However unjust, there is a result. So if you've beaten them, they may say, you should never have done this, it is a scandal. But they can't say, I blame the judges, you know.
Right.
They can't say, I pirouetted well. Because, you know, they pirouetted less well. It's quite clear. You know, so there's nothing to be done at that stage.
Right.
That makes it much easier, I think. Like with sport, I mean, you know, something happens. You can blame the referee. You can jump up and down and squeak. But basically, there is a result. And especially in chess, the great thing about chess is you're naked, mentally speaking. I mean, okay, you have all the armor you've gathered beforehand, all your opening theory, all your knowledge. But when you're actually playing, you're at a board. You are sitting opposite another person. Thank God you don't have to wear a mask anymore. And you are making battle, which is why cheating is so repulsive over the board. I mean, it's a bit different when you're sitting at a computer because, you know, you're playing a computer game, really. You know, but you know, you are naked, and so it's important that, you know, you do your mud wrestling in person. You don't have a...
Like I was mentioning to you before we recorded, despite, you know, widespread rumors of Magnus and Hikaru not having a great personal relationship, you could even sense their sporting respect for each other in their post-game interviews. That they love that there's this other person that can challenge them.
Of course there is. I mean, you know, of course it annoys you. If you want to be number one and some other punk is trying to be number one, then obviously it's hard to be really good friends. I mean, of course, you know, Dalmata, the new super, played a candidates match, didn't they? And that was really tough because they were basically best friends. And then I think they used to have breakfast together before they went off to beat the crap out of each other, you know. And, you know, because of course they were, you know, they'd been friends all their lives and they'd worked with Mark Tveretsky and, you know, so that was very difficult. But I mean, you know, and I think their relationship was never quite the same afterwards because it had undergone such a stress test. But, you know, you can easily like people who you do very unpleasant things to in a completely predetermined environment, which doesn't involve physical violence. I mean, I suppose even boxers quite often like each other when they're not beating each other up, or sometimes do, you know. I mean, you know, they're in a predetermined arena. They hit each other and then they can... Certainly other sportsmen, footballers and things may like each other when there isn't quite so much violence. And rugby players, you know, often used to go for a drink afterwards. And, you know, rugby is a fairly, fairly violent game and without protective equipment, although that very much of it.
Right. Speaking of boxing, it jogged my memory. I don't suppose you caught the chess boxing match between Lawrence Trent and Amon Hambleton. And
actually,
then,
somebody showed me it. Yeah, I thought it was ridiculous. I do think it's ridiculous that people wear a helmet when they're playing chess to stop the sound coming in and take it off so that somebody can punch them. And I just think it's dangerous. You know, if they can both box, then nobody's probably going to be hurt. But, you know, people have been hurt at this. I mean, Lawrence Trent got knocked over twice, didn't he? And the referee then quite rightly stopped it.
Yeah.
And Lawrence can whinge, but it's absurd. I mean, you know, it's not a macho thing. If you can fight, you can fight. If I could fight, then I would occasionally think it was necessary to, but I can't. So, I mean, not, you know, if things happen. But, I mean, but you know, if you can't do it, then doing it is ridiculous. And you're risking serious damage to your head or to your eyes or something, you know. Because if somebody punches you hard in the face, it can hurt you, can't it? Obviously.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you can't box, it's not very hard for them to punch you in the face. And so, you know, what is the point of that? You know, you can beat them at chess, but you're not going to be compos mentis to do it, are you?
Yeah. Yeah, it's not really my thing either, but it was immensely popular. It'll be interesting.
Oh, I'm sure it was, yes. Well, I mean, Lawrence Trent waving his hands about it being knocked over, you know. I mean, if Lawrence wants to do that, I mean, I guess it's sort of impressive in a macho sense that he's prepared to do it, but I also think it's completely, you know, you should be able to box to do it. He obviously can't.
He would beg to differ. He said on Twitter that he was disappointed that he didn't show his stuff properly, but
he lost about 30 seconds, didn't he? And thank God it did, is all I can say. Because the guy he was playing chess with and fighting, is he a grandmaster as well, this guy?
Yeah, Zaman Hambleton.
And he can box as well, yeah?
Well, he was a little coy. I mean, Lawrence was very public about all the training he was doing. We only found out Zaman can box when we saw it.
And he could, couldn't he?
He sure could, yeah. Impressive display.
I just think it's really silly. I mean, I understand the idea, you know, mens sanus and corpore sano and all this stuff. But I mean, actually, you know, whatever the opposite was, I can't do any more Latin than that. I mean, you know, a cracked mind and a cracked body, I would say. And, you know, it's quite likely to happen. So I don't approve.
Okay. Well, let's get a few more chess stories before we let you go, if we could.
John.
So you're great. So you've mentioned that Larsen was one of your boyhood heroes. You played through his games, and then he was the first grandmaster you beat. I'd love to hear about what that felt like.
He didn't play very well, actually. It was the first round of Lone Pine. He actually won the tournament afterwards. I got about 50%. He had jet lag, and he played some rubbish opening, and he kept on making decisions that helped me, so I didn't have to make too many decisions myself. So I just beat him. I mean, it just happened. I mean, it should have happened much earlier because I was a decent... I wasn't an IM yet. I think I got an IM norm, possibly my IM title at that tournament, actually. So I wasn't even an international master. I mean, I was really a very late developer by modern standards. You know, I think it's 1977 or 78 I became an IM. And, it was nice. You know, I beat him. He probably wasn't very pleased and stopped off somewhat without. Then I played, did I play Reshevsky and draw with him or something? Then I lost to Wally Brown at some point in that tournament.
And you played Tal once, is that right?
No, I played Tal five or six times.
Oh, sorry.
I lost two or three times, drew two or three times. I also played some Blitz with him. And I did win some games, but I lost one, including a double bishop sacrifice, which he then published in 64, which I was amused by. I thought he was a chess player who was world champion who adored chess, which it's not clear. There have been chess players who adore winning, but whether they adore chess quite as much as Misha did isn't clear. Obviously, Magnus does because he plays bullet and things, you know, because, I mean, Botvinnik harumphed about playing five-minute chess, didn't he?
Right.
He thought playing five-minute chess was a denigration of chess. And here you've got Magnus occasionally playing hyperbullet, certainly playing bullet a lot, quite seriously. So, yeah.
And you've written that Tal had the impressive skill of playing extremely well, even when it looked like he was going to pass out drunk in the middle of a blitz session.
So well, I mean, I think even when he was about to pass out, he was
right.
Well, it was his native language, wasn't it? I mean, you can still often slur speech reasonably well when you're drunk, and if it's your native language, that's what he could do. And he could. Yeah.
And did you have occasion to share drinks with him?
Certainly not competitively. I mean, I think we had post-mortems where maybe some of the game. Tournaments we had post mortems, there was alcohol on prees, and we may have had a drink each, but certainly not in the proper sense of drinking.
Not peak tall drinking.
No. But of course, I mean, he only had one kidney, this man as well.
Yeah.
And, you know,
yeah, we shouldn't make light of it in a sense, but.
He was a genius. It was a great shot when he died, really, because you sort of thought he was one of these people who was immortal.
Right.
Because it was obvious he should have died so many times that he hadn't. Yeah.
And I forgot the story, John, but I had a note in my outline that you had a Lubojevic story from a game with him.
Oh, that was in London, yeah. Yeah, I like Luba as well, actually. We played in London at the tournament where I got my first Grandmaster norm, which was the Philip and Drew Kings. And we're getting into a time scramble. And he throws his queen along the eighth rank.
Right, now it comes back to me. Go on.
So it gets to about somewhere between g8 and h8. So since we're playing blitz chess, I go to push his queen back onto the right square and to play my move. Because I'm playing a five-minute chess, and I'm just going to put his piece where it should be and get on with it. But, you know, we're in a five-minute game at this point. But as I go to pick, touch his queen, he thinks I'm about to take his queen. Not unreasonably. So he starts screaming at me.
So it landed on the wrong, just to be clear for listeners, it landed kind of on the wrong square, but you knew where he meant to put it, and you tried to correct it.
I was just going to push it. I was going to move it with my finger, then move my king. My king was on h7, and queen g8 check. I was going to play king h6, but I was just going to push his queen wherever it was. Did he put land on h8 when it should have been on g8? I can't remember. Anyway,
I would guess he moved it not far enough, but rather than too far. But
anyway, I can find out. I mean, the game is Lyubovich, Spielman, Philipson, Drew, Kings, 1980. You can find it. Anyway, so I went to adjust his king and play the move, just as I would if I was playing Blitz, which maybe is not what you're supposed to do, but it's what I do in a five-minute session. And he thought I was going to take it, so he started screaming that his queen was on the right square. So eventually, there was a lot of noise, and Stuart Rubin came along and stopped the clock and said, "Well, it's on the other square," which it was, sort of. And so I thought I was still worse, so I offered a draw while this was being considered. He agreed to draw, and so the game finished after that. And people were impressed and John Lund gave me a nice draw in the last round to get my GM on, which was kind of him. Partly because I could probably have stolen a whole point if I wanted to, but I didn't want to. I didn't think that wasn't what I was trying to do. Well, you know, if you're playing. So we changed mode, and definitely I wasn't going to take his queen. I knew I was going to push it either that way or that way. I'm sitting black, aren't I? So I'm going this way. Actually, probably it's from h8 to g8, because look, my hand goes over to move my king. It's going to be in my right hand, yeah? So it goes over there. So if I'm going to push it with my little finger, it's going to be from h8 to g8, isn't it?
Right.
I can't remember. Because I think on h8 it would have been on prees backwards, whereas probably my queen was in f6 and the king on h7, and I was going to play king h6, which is the only move. But he just put his queen too far, I think. Anyway, that's what happened. And yeah, he was very nice to me in a tournament in Spain. He had already beat me in when I had a horrible, horrible start. He was very sweet to me, and I thought that's very kind.
Ben Feingold said that I know that you do some streaming. He said that Lyubovich would have been one of the all-time great chess streamers. Do you agree with that?
He's still alive.
Yeah, I know, but he's not streaming.
No, I do very little now because my eyes are very crap. But when I do, I enjoy it. And I normally just do commentary. I don't play people. I mean, I see these boys playing day after day, playing against their customers. And I just think that must be quite a hard way to make money. I mean, obviously, it's both an easy way and a hard way.
Right.
Because you're playing all these awful games occasionally, and you're going to lose some of them, and you're going to commentate on them. And, you know, it's hard work to maintain a patina of enthusiasm, I would think. But I suppose you're working, so you're working. You know, it's like being away from something, more or less. You know,
and so you've mentioned a couple of times, John, issues with your eyes, and it also, it's on your Wikipedia page. They mentioned that you had something fixed in your 20s, and you had a jump in chest strength at that point.
I think in 1980 the first thing happened. I mean, at the moment they're not terribly good, but we shall see. But you know, I mean, I still, with the eyes as they are at the moment, I've just won this Blitz tournament, so you know, I can still operate.
So do you mind giving a little bit of context? Like, was there an incident, or your eyes have just been bad?
I'm extremely short-sighted. I'm round about minus 20 in both eyes.
Which means
you get eye disease. You get things happening in the back of your eyes. So I've got some macular degeneration.
Do they hurt?
No, it doesn't hurt. It just means,
that's good.
It means your eyesight is bad.
And is it true that when you were young, there was an issue and then it helped your chess when you got corrective?
No, I mean, I had a hemorrhage. First, I had a hemorrhage in the eye in 1980, and I went to Moorfields and it got sorted out. And I think 80 or 81. And yeah, I mean, obviously, I was very frightened then. I mean, you know, and you realize after a while that you're going to be reasonably okay for a while, touch wood. And yeah, so it's a problem. But, you know, I mean, you just have to, obviously, as long as you can see, you can see. I can't see, as you can see.
But so it sounds like you streaming isn't like a, you might pop on occasionally, but it's not a big priority right now.
Well, the thing is that if I do 4 or 5 hours, I'm absolutely knackered. And then when I compensate, I feel I should do a whole session. But maybe I should just do half sessions, say. I'll do a couple of hours, because a couple of hours is okay. But doing 4 hours of commentary or something, although I enjoy it, I mean, I have not very many people come on to my channel, but 30 or 40 people maybe, you know. And we have no trouble at all. We hardly ever have any trolls. And, you know, people make puns and jokes and things, but, you know, not dirty jokes, nice jokes.
Right.
And things, and it's just very pleasant, and I enjoy it. I know I'm going shopping for you soon. Yes.
I love the dedication. You're being rounded up. Sorry, go on.
Yeah, and so, yeah. Well, you know, I enjoy it. I like it. I have, I don't know, 1,500 followers or something, and get 40 or 50 people at a time, or sometimes fewer, depending on when. And I'm just not doing it very regularly at the moment because it's a bit of a strain. But I mean, okay. I hope I'll do it. I try to do it once, twice a month or something, but not more than that.
Okay. And you do some teaching as well. Are you taking students, John?
Yeah, I take students. I teach either by sharing screens on Chess Space or on Lee Chess, and my details are on Lee Chess.
Yeah.
I've got a Lee Chess teaching page. Don't really teach on chess.com, but I teach on Lee Chess or. And yeah, I teach quite a lot, but not a huge amount. I mean, and I enjoy it. You know, I like, basically what I do is I look at people's games, talk to them about it, try to wind them up, show them some tactics, try to sacrifice my queen as often as possible, and then show them some Grandmaster games and maybe teach them endings. Not very much opening work. If you want a heavy sausage opening coach, that's not me. It really isn't. Because, I mean, of course, I can look at a position and say, I think this, and I'll have a view. But for the nitty-gritty of going through an opening move by move, working out exactly what you want to do, I'm just not very good at it.
It makes sense, yeah. We've got engines for that.
We have got engines. You have to know how to use them, of course.
Yeah.
You have to be in control of the engine.
Sorry, go ahead.
You have to be in control of the engine. It mustn't control you.
Yeah, good advice. And do you have a favorite type of student? Do you like the conscientious or the laissez-faire?
The laissez-faire, but I mean also just people who are interesting, people who are nice to chat to. You know, you chat a bit, you do some chess, you look at some more chess, occasionally you chat for a bit. I mean, you know, I teach both people who are really close to beginners and people who are quite strong. And obviously, they're completely different things. Teaching a strong player is, you know, you're seriously engaged. Whereas with somebody weaker, you're trying to engage at a level where they can get something out of you.
Okay. And one last question, John. In reviewing your chess-based news column, which I've read for years, but obviously I went through them kind of sequentially, getting ready for this interview, I noticed that you've kind of shifted from doing a lot of amateur game analysis to telling more stories and more top-level chess analysis lately. Was that like a conscious thing?
Yeah, that was conscious. At some point, I did an agony column. So it was an agony column of people's games for I don't know how long it lasted. I can find out. I have a complete list of my things. And at some point, when the editorship at Chess Space changed, we had a chat and they said, well, why don't you just write a column and write it once a fortnight? Because I used to do once a week, which was too often. It was too much work, really. And so I just started doing freestyle. And, you know, the latest one, all this thing, I don't know if you've seen the latest one with all these queens. It's a little bit, it's a bit monochrome, but it's quite interesting in a way. Certainly the positions with three queens each are rather amazing. You know, the fact that there are a couple of games in a database of 3 million where both players have three queens on the board. One of them, they have three queens and a board for about 6 or 7 moves, about 12 half moves or something. You just wouldn't think that was possible, really, would you?
No, you wouldn't.
And obviously, this isn't two children playing some ridiculous game. where somebody queens all their pawns and then tries to make the opponent's king without giving stalemate. This was the first SDIM tournament. I assume it's a real game. you know, I looked at, I mean, they played 60 moves. So I can't believe they'd said, we're going to get three queens each and have a draw. Didn't look like that at all. So I just thought, this is amazing. Even though I wasn't really analyzing it, I was just letting the engine do its stuff. And
Well, I enjoy the new format. I like it better, I have to say.
Okay, so, well, if your readers ever want to send in suggestions, I from time to time run out of ideas. So if they want to, they can email me and I will be very happy, or they can send suggestions to Chessbase. That's, you know, because excellent. Please do.
I mean, just from my perspective, if you just look at a top 100 list and just pick a player and just write about that player, to me, that would be very interesting. I mean, you've got so much personal experience, but also just your knowledge where you can look at their games and share things that regular people can't pick up.
Yeah, I could do that. I don't really do that very often. I mean, I do mention players, but not so much in that way. Yeah.
But I'll be sure to link to your email address so that people, whether they're interested in lessons or have suggestions, can reach out.
Yes, and to my Lee Chess teaching page, please, as well.
Will do.
You know how to, you know, just go Lee Chess coaches.
You can even just Google Lee Chess coaches Jonathan Spielman.
That'll get you there.
Okay. Well, Jonathan, it's been a true honor. I really appreciate your taking the time. So many fantastic stories. Thank you for coming on the podcast.
Pleasure. I've really enjoyed it.
Good. Glad to hear it. And I hope I didn't get you in trouble with your wife for not going shopping yet.
No, we got time, but I definitely need to go and shop soon. Okay. Cheers,
all right. Thanks so much.
Cheers. Bye.
Thanks to everyone who helps make Perpetual Chess possible. Big shout out to my producer, Matthew Passy. I'd also like to thank the Blue Wire Podcast Network, with whom we are proud to be affiliated. Be sure to follow us on social media, Beneficial1 on Twitter, at Perpetual Chess on Instagram, or you can join the Perpetual Chess Facebook group. You can email me, ben@perpetualchesspod.com. And of course, last but not least, I'd like to give major thanks to the Perpetual Chess Patreon and PayPal supporters. Those who choose to join that community based on their level of support can do things like submit questions for guests of the show, have access to live Zoom Q&A lectures with grandmasters who often have appeared on the show, going over chess games, answering questions, stuff like that. And you can even get access to ad-free Perpetual Chess if that's your preference. So, but most of all, thanks to everyone for listening, and we will catch you all on the...
Podcast Network.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.